Susan Robb for Teachers for a New Era. I'm talking with David Smith. David's been working in the world of education for a long time. He was a classroom teacher who evolved an innovative approach to teaching seventh graders geography, which led to the development of a curriculum program that's become known around the world called Mapping the World by Heart. His work won a U.S. Department of Education A+ for Breaking the Mold Award, and since 1992, he's given lectures and workshops on the topic all around the world. In 2002, a book called If the World Were a Village was published by Kids Can Press to great acclaim. It helps children and adults understand what the world would be like if it was represented by a village of 100 people. It helps them understand our interrelationships, the environment, and the world we live in. It's now in its 17th printing in North America. There are 19 editions around the world, and it's been published in many, many languages, including Spanish, Portuguese, Greek, Turkish, Arabic, Thai, Korean, Japanese, and Braille. His next book, If America Were a Village, helps us to understand this country. Now, David, thank you for joining me. You know, what strikes me about this topic, and particularly with If America Were a Village coming out, is that it just seems that it's more important than ever, given what's going on politically and environmentally in our world. Can you talk to me a little bit about what's changed since the first book, If the World Were a Village, came out?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Susan. The changes since 2002 are phenomenal. Every year or so, I get an email from Kids Can Press that says, can you please tell us what we need to change before the next printing? And as you said, there are now 17 printings in North America, and I guess I've edited the data 5 or 6 times. Some of the numbers have changed just a little. Hindi has moved up from the third most widely spoken language to basically being in a tie with a statistical dead heat with English as the second most widely spoken, and it's due to go ahead of English in terms of the number of native speakers in the world. Other things have changed trivially. Some things have changed dramatically. The one that I like to cite most often is telephones. Even 7 years ago, when the book was first published, there were 14 telephones for this village of 100 people. And today, it's well over 60. And almost 100% of those telephones are mobile phones, cellular phones, because all over the world, in places where nobody will ever wire a hardwired phone into a house, people are putting up cells and either selling very cheaply or giving away handsets in order to make money on the time that they can sell using the handsets. So that number has changed. One of my favorite quotes, I love to cite this, Paul Allen, who was Bill Gates' partner at Microsoft, gave a very famous speech 14, 15 years ago now, called The Digital Divide, about those who have it and those who don't. And one of the things that he said was that over half the people in the world are born, live their entire lives, and die without ever making or receiving a telephone call. And while that was true in 1995, it certainly is no longer true. So there have been some real geometric changes. And with If America Were a Village, I've said to several people who've asked me this question that the numbers change every day, and that I really hope that this book is not taken as some form of gospel, but just as a tool that can be used to generate ideas and viewpoints and extrapolations and experimentation.
You know, one of the things that has struck me about this, you know, we're talking about the national debt and things like that, is that we've become sort of inured to the idea of what does a billion mean, what does a trillion mean. It's just, you know, it's just another spelling. It almost feels like it doesn't feel like a real thing. So, but you know, this has been something that you've been focusing on for a long time. I mean, when you first came to start doing this. What made you feel that there was a need to bring it to a scale we could see?
Well, the story is that it actually began in my grade 7 classroom, where one of my 7th graders, at the beginning of a school year, actually it was probably like 87, asked me whether he should take French or Spanish as a foreign language, and he said, I just don't know how to decide which language is most important. And I asked him to be a little clearer, because I said both languages are very important. And he said, well, if our classroom were the world, how many of us would speak English, how many would speak French, how many would speak Spanish, and so on. So we looked it up, and he took Spanish because it was more widely spoken than French, but that was the germ of the idea. And I actually put together about 45 or 50 pages of data using the idea of reducing 6.2 billion at the time, or less than that in 1987, to 100 people. And since then, Kids Can Press published If the World Were a Village with 12 of those pages. So I've got this collection of other pages that are kind of fun. I call it The Dark Side of the Village, disease and cigarettes and things like that. So
the other thing, too, is, I mean, people can look. There's a lot of information on this. There's mapping.com, which is a website that talks about some of the curriculum part of it. Tell me a little bit about what that curriculum looks like.
Well, Mapping the World by Heart takes the basic idea that the maps that we carry around in our heads are the maps that are the most important to any of us. They're the maps we use every day. And so it says to teachers, here are some tools you can use to help your seventh graders construct a really usable world map in their heads and carry it with them throughout the rest of their school career and through their lives. And it does it through some quite new and interesting and innovative strategies, and also some very old-fashioned ones. There is some rote memory work involved, but there's also lots and lots of small group work and small group interactions and kids working with other kids in order to develop activities that another group of kids will be using and so on. So it's very exciting to children, and teachers love it because it doesn't say begin here and every day you do this and at the end of the year this is where you'll get. It says do what you're comfortable with, find a really neat way of approaching this topic with your students and see how it feels, and if it isn't a good fit, try it this way and so on. So it's very comfortable for teachers too. Scholastic has now published 7 full complete revisions of it that I've done for them.
One thing I do know, you know, when you see surveys and things about what we know, especially in America, about geography, it's pretty frightening. I mean, I think in some ways it struck me that in other countries, you know, partly in Europe and whatever, places are more connected because there you can get from one country to the next within short amounts of time. But here, there's a lot we don't know. We don't understand the interconnectedness of our states, and we certainly have that much harder time a lot of times envisioning the rest of the world. What's your observation about some of that?
Well, the National Geographic and the Roper Organization do a poll every 4 or 5 years. In the most recent one, 10 industrial countries, Western countries, well, that's not quite right, one of them was Japan, but anyway, 10 industrial countries that where the 18 to 24 year olds were tested on dozens of questions relative to world geography and understanding of world populations and so on. And the U.S. always comes in very near the bottom, if not right at the bottom. And well, the numbers that are just stunning. 1/6 of the 18 to 24-year-olds tested in Texas could not correctly answer the question, what country borders the U.S. on the south? Things like that. So, yes, we're very blinded. And when National Geographic and the Roper people went back to the people they tested to see if they could find out what people who did well on the test had in common and what people who didn't do well on the test had in common, there were two factors. One, as you mentioned, because of the closeness of the countries of Europe, one was travel to another country. People who had traveled to another country in the previous year did better as a whole on these polls. The other was the ability to speak a foreign language. People who could speak a foreign language, who had studied it in school and used it, in one way or another, maybe even in their lives, found it easier to do well on those questions.
So maybe because they imagine being in other places differently. Let me ask you something I've wondered about. With, you know, there's been so much with GPS, and, you know, so many of us have gotten attached to having that in our cars. Personally, I think it's very, you know, nice and helpful. But what do you think about that in the context of mapping skills? Are our mapping skills even more at risk, do you think, of being lost?
In fact, I think maybe it's the opposite. I think that GPS presents you a map and says, here's a way to go. So you're actually looking at a map instead of relying on an internal map that may be faulty or saying, well, I know how to get there. And I mean, I have a lot of fun with the GPS in my car because I often know a different way to go that I prefer. And so the GPS is always stopping and saying, recalculating. And in fact, anytime my wife and I have a moment when we're not sure that we're doing what we are meant to be doing, we'll stop and look at each other and say, recalculating. But GIS and GPS are very useful tools, and if people see them as that, I don't think that mapping skills are any more in danger than they have been. If they become crutches, then and the message is, well, you don't need to look at maps anymore, then that is a serious issue. But the data isn't all in yet, but it doesn't appear that that's what's happening. I mean, there are wonderful stories about people who rely too much on their GPS and end up driving into the ocean or so on because the GPS says turn right here and go a mile, and they turn right there and there's the beach and there's the ocean and they drive right into it, or they try to fit down a lane that's a walking street only and it's too narrow for their truck because they're not looking.
No, it's so funny. Well, tell me, when you do your presentations or when you're traveling, I'm sure you get a lot of questions, but what tips do you have for parents and for teachers about getting kids to want to engage over geography?
Well, in the back matter, in both If America Were a Village and If the World Were a Village, there are essays that I wrote that are full of tips. One of the things that I like to say is, you know, anything that reinforces the importance of geography to the people in their lives will help children understand that geography is important. So put maps on the wall, play geography games in the car, even something as simple as license plate games or name all the countries in Africa that begin with A or that end with the same letter that they begin with or things like that. And there's some good samples of those kinds of games in the back matter of If the World Were a Village. But anything at all that says to kids, geography is important to me, and here's why I want it to be important to you too, has great value. And asking children questions to which there's no right answer is a very valuable tool as well, a way to get kids thinking about some of these critical issues. Why do you think that so many people are hungry when, in fact, there's enough food in the world if we could divide it differently? Why do you think some countries have really well settled boundaries and don't have any boundary issues and other countries do, even though the boundaries are equally clearly demarcated? And things like that. Just to get kids thinking about these issues so that they're interested, they want to go look at a map, they want to see what the story is. And anytime you hear a place named on the news, you say, let's go see where that is. You know, maps and globes are so critical in the home and in the classroom.
And if somebody came up and asked you, some of the, like a kid said to you, well, why would geography matter? You know, kids love to do that. What do you say to them, or would you, when it comes to geography, why does it matter a lot in your future to understand geography?
Well, two things are going through my head. One is a simple, if you're going to go out in the world, you need to know about the world. But the other thing is that geography is probably not the solution to all of the world's problems, but it's definitely part of the lubricant to make the ship move down the way is better. And it's such an important piece of how we understand other people and what we know about other people. At the time that If the World Were a Village was published, one radio interviewer was taking calls from kids, And one of the kids who called in said, well, what does everybody in the world have for breakfast? Does everybody have the same thing that I do? And it was a great opportunity, real teachable moment to say, look, some people do. They'll eat the cereal that you eat or the eggs that you eat. Some people may have something else that you could recognize, rice or fish. Some people may have something you don't recognize at all. And yeah, there are some people who don't have anything. But for the most part, at the end of their sleep, people get up and they have something to eat before they start their day. And it hardly matters what it is, as long as you understand that, yeah, everybody in the world's having breakfast. And we all sit down together at that table. And so it's important to know who the other people at the table are.
And I think back to what you said earlier about the cell phones and all of that, it demonstrates the idea that we really are more and more interconnected. We're seeing it through the internet, through cell phones. It's critical that we understand who the other people are in the world that we're in.
Well, I think the dark side of that is that as we become more interconnected, we also seem to be becoming more tribal. And there anonymously did a survey of all of the tiny little nations without a state that are struggling for some form of independence, and they estimate that in the next century there may be as many as 100 new countries striving for membership in the UN or the European Union, and there's something like 5,000 or 6,000 of these little nations without a state worldwide. I mean, some of them you know about, and we think about Kalmykia and Nagorno-Karabakh and so on, but even Normandy and Brittany and Wales and Scotland and so on, there are independence movements in all of these places, some of them more powerful and more noticeable and more valid than others, but still important. And so we're very interconnected now. You can text other people easily no matter where they are in the world, and you can pick up your phone and call them, you can Skype them, etc. But if we're not really paying attention to where they are and who they are and what their lives are about and what their lives are like, then we haven't made a lot of progress.
I think we'll be interesting to see where things are headed, both politically and economically and a lot of other ways, and hopefully people will be more willing to engage over geography and understanding each other. Well, David, thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much, Susan.